Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Are Americans born in other parts of the world better off than their neighbors with U.S. birth certificates? By at least some important measures, they are. Social scientists studying the so-called immigrant paradox have found that as a whole, even those new Americans born in very poor or very violent countries are in better physical and mental health than the general U.S. population. My guest today has been covering immigrant issues for years and wanted to understand what blend of old country customs and American culture might account for the welfare of those who move here from abroad. Claudia Kolger is a former bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times and member of the Houston Chronicle's editorial board. Her new book is called The Immigrant Advantage: What We Can Learn from Newcomers to America About Health, Happiness, and Hope. Claudia, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
You have a particular interest in the blending of different cultures into a uniquely American identity, not only in your professional life, but in your personal life. Can you tell us a little bit about your family?
Well, yes, I'll go back just one generation, but I live in Houston, Texas, but I was born and raised in Washington, D.C., and my mom and dad were from outside D.C. My dad was from Baltimore, Maryland, from a Jewish family that's been here for over 100 years, and my mother is from Mexico City, and she's been living in the United States since she was, on and off since she was about 12, but retains many Mexican traditions and a love of that culture, as well as a great love and participation in this culture. So they were crazy about each other, and they made it fun to have these different backgrounds and cherry pick the joy out of them. And they really took a relish in each other's cultures too. So I grew up with a kind of a tradition without really being conscious of it, of more is more.
So I mentioned a little bit of this in the introduction, but talk, if you would, in more detail about the overall welfare of immigrants as compared with their U.S.-born neighbors.
Well, I'm glad that you asked that, because it does need to be qualified. In many measures, they tend to be more healthy physically, and there's research that suggests that even more resilient mentally than native-born. So it's foreign-born versus native-born. In their own countries, they have a lot of challenges, and these figures don't hold true for them in the very poor countries from which many of them come. It's that they come here, well, first of all, I should stress, we don't know. It's this is a work in progress. Scientists, social scientists and doctors have been noticing that foreign-born people, especially Latinos, seem to have longer lives, I think since the 30s, but the actual documentation has been escalating for the past couple of decades only. So it seems to be a combination of several things. First of all, selection. Even if you don't go through a formal immigration process to come to this country, as I say, the desert and human predators and fear and danger, they do their own selection. So social scientists think that the people who come here from other countries tend to be resilient, optimistic, motivated, and with a good baseline of health. You're not going to make that trek from India or China or Mexico, leaving everything you know behind if you're frail. Mm-hmm. So selection is a big part of it, but behavior seems to be another part of it. And these behaviors are not all of them so very, very foreign. There are things that our grandparents and often our parents were familiar with that we have forgotten or actually felt we haven't needed because of all of our good fortune in recent decades. But a lot of these behaviors, as we know, a lot of these old-fashioned behaviors are really conducive to health and well-being, a sense of inner health, a sense of connectedness that we now know really is very deeply connected to physical health. And then the one piece I want to throw on that is really gaining some momentum, and since I've written my book too, is that one piece of that is going to be smoking, that the foreign-born seem to smoke less than long-term native-born Americans.
So I want to talk about some of the traditions that you explore here. And the one that most fascinated you and ultimately had the greatest impact on your life was something called a hui. And please correct my pronunciation if it's off. This is a money-saving club?
Yes. I'll pronounce it too, and I will get it wrong too, but I'll be closer. It's spelled H-U-I, and it's pronounced hoi, mm-hmm. And it's a tonal language, so my Vietnamese friends to this day look at me blankly when I try to say it. But it roughly rhymes with the word boy. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and it's a savings club, pure and simple. And there is no profit you could possibly gain from it. There's some risk. You could lose your money from it. But basically, when all goes right, which is really almost universally true for the Vietnamese who practice it at the kind of the homespun level, you sweat and you do it for a year and you saved your money. That's all it does. But that's hard. That's really hard. So would you like me to tell you how it works?
Please do.
Okay. You can start off with a base number of around 12 people. And in Vietnam, and a lot of Asian countries do this as well, in Vietnam, a lot of times the person who starts it is someone who actually needs a big infusion of cash for an operation, say, or a funeral or a wedding. So the ringleader then selects, say, a dozen people from his or her friends. And it's not just the most fun people or even the people with the most money. It's the most reliable people who are most concerned about their face and their name and their reputation. That's a crucial point because those people are going to be coming back month after month, ponying up a certain amount of money. In the club I did, it was $200 month after month. And each month, one person gets all the money, and it's always in cash. It's no plastic allowed, and it traditionally is not checks either. Each month, everyone in the group ponies up the money, and one person walks home with a big lump sum of cash, no interest, no collateral except for their reputation, because then they have to keep on coming back, even after they spent the money, even after it's no fun anymore. They have to keep on coming back until everyone has walked away with that lump sum of money. And that's it. That's how you save your money, and you do it until there are 12 months taken up. And for the advanced class, which I certainly didn't dabble in, people will bid to get the kitty instead of pulling straws or writing it down. We have a little what we call our Bible. It's just a little tiny book. We've written down everyone's due date. If someone needs the money, though, if something has come up, you can certainly ask your group, hey, can I switch? Can I switch with so-and-so? Because another colloquial name for it is a friendship loan. Friendship loan. And for me, I started as pretty much as a game, but it's no game to the people who originate this concept in Asia, and there are variations all over the world, too. It's for people who have no credit, whose banks are unreliable, who physically have no place to keep their money safe. And so the safest thing they can do is invest in their friends. And there's always a risk, but it's the safest alternative.
So people might be listening to this, Claudia, and thinking, well, I could just put $200 a month away in my own bank account and there's no risk. But it seems like something that's really important about this whole setup is the social component to it.
Absolutely. And people do. And people, Vietnamese, who've been here, you know, since 1975, they have bank accounts and 401ks and many have investments. They do all that. This is now used to squeeze that extra $200 out that maybe you can't save quite as easily. The ones that I squandered on things like a kind of an expensive tea habit at 4 o'clock from Starbucks, or little indulgences that actually don't give much pleasure but really do add up to a lot. Those are the things that are hard, really hard to resist because they seem so small. When you have a group of friends you're looking forward to seeing, it's going to be fun, it's going to be a party, and you know you will lose them all if you don't have that extra bit squeezed out from your finances, that $200 they've been waiting for. That is huge motivation to be that extra bit more frugal.
And was it difficult for you to find a group of friends to do this with you?
What a great question. No, although many friends wanted nothing to do with it. I'm a journalist, and as one of my friends said in the book, you know, journalists, I think they're experimenters, and they have a code. You know, we spend a lot of time talking about ethics and, you know, I'm not letting that go in with my name attached to it. And journalists really, really care about their name. And so it was a nice fit. So I had a lot of people I trusted. But interestingly, some of the people from the group who leaped in immediately mm-hmm. were the people from Mexico. And I have, it's Houston, I know a lot of people who are Mexicans, and you know, they're actually immigrants from Mexico. And they said, oh yeah, I'm familiar with this. We had this in our apartment building. It's called the Tanda. So a lot of people from around the world are familiar with this concept. And I should add one more thing,
go ahead.
Which is that this was not big stakes. It was not easy for all of us to squeeze out that $200 extra a month. This was a little extra, but you know, we were not high rolling there. My standard was this was money I knew that I squandered anyhow, and it drove me crazy.
And it must be nice when you get that payoff, and I guess you invested in yourself.
Yes, you know, I have little kids, and I'm squirreling everything away and thinking about the future. But because I wasn't taking this from any known source of money for my children's future, I spent it the first year on some braces.
That thing you'd always wanted but never had.
Not justifiable in any way. Uh-huh. And as I mentioned in the book, people just said, why? Because I wanted them, and because I told myself it was some sort of investment in the future, but really, it's because I could, and I didn't feel I was taking away from something that was really important, which was, you know, my kid's future.
Well, your photograph on the book jacket looks sensational, so it was definitely worth the investment.
Thank you.
Another tradition that you write about comes from Mexico, La Cuarentena, which is a tradition in which a new mother essentially stays home with her baby and gets a lot of outside help for, is it 40 days?
40 days. Mm-hmm. 40 days. Yes. And the thing that's interesting, well, there's several things that really grabbed me about that. But one of those is that while the Vietnamese Savings Club is practiced by all socioeconomic groups, the cuarentena, and it's related to the word cuarenta, or 40, is practiced most religiously, taken most seriously by people who are either indigenous or mixed or live in very remote traditional places. They live in places where they don't have doctors, and so the care that they give to a mother is all important. It is a matter of life and death.
Hmm.
So in Mexico and Chiapas, which is where most of the moms I talked to came from, they don't have doctors or medicine, even if something went terribly wrong in childbirth. And there's a really, really high infant mortality rate. And so they're very preoccupied with the health of a baby. But even more, they are obsessed with the health of a new mother.
Hmm.
And the reasoning is that infant mortality is high, and it is heartbreaking. But if something happens to the mother, physically or even psychologically, I don't think they would put it in those terms, but if something disables the mother, the whole family is at great risk. So that's why they have this tradition, and I'll tell you more details if you want to hear about it.
Absolutely. And in fact, we're about to come into a break here, but just quickly, it would seem like in Chiapas or other remote places, there are family members and friends close by. Again, is it a challenge for women who are now living in the United States to build this little coalition around themselves?
Absolutely, it is. Mm-hmm. It's you know, it's one of those paradoxes that it's easier for women with, you know, almost non-existent incomes and no other health services mm-hmm. in it than it is for women like me in a city with lots of services. But I want to tell you very quickly that these are all traditions that have adapted and evolved over the years. They're adapting the United States. I adapted it, but I saw Mexican women getting help from their husbands. They didn't have their sisters and cousins. And I just heard from a reader who said that her mother wasn't available, nor her grandmother. It was her granddad who coddled her for 40 days, took care of her like a baby when she had a baby.
We'll talk more about this with journalist Claudia Kolker in a moment. Her new book is called The Immigrant Advantage, What We Can Learn from Newcomers to America About Health, Happiness, and Hope. You can join our conversation by calling in now to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Claudia Kolker. She is former Los Angeles Times bureau chief and a member of the Houston Chronicle's editorial board. Her new book is called The Immigrant Advantage: What We Can Learn from Newcomers to America About Health, Happiness, and Hope. If you'd like to join our conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Claudia, for mothers who are looking to have this 40 days of time alone to bond with their babies and when they get a lot of help, you do have to sort of have the right people around you. Talk a little bit more about how people find the sort of support team that they'll get.
Well, one of the big keywords here that we're not so familiar with in daily life as native-born Americans is reciprocity. Mm. It's disruptive and it's exhausting for anyone who does this or someone else. You don't have to do it for 40 days. But there's kind of the expectation that I did this for you, I stepped up for you, and you'll do it for me one day. And so it is a challenge for women, for immigrant women, to do it in this culture. And if you do it halfway, it can terribly backfire. You could be at home, not moving about outside, but terribly lonely if mm-hmm. someone's working and just popping in to give you something to eat. A key part of the quarantena is social contact and reassurance and calm, quiet company. So that's a really important piece to keep in mind, and it is hard to achieve. I fell into this backwards. I didn't know of its existence till after I had my girls, but I got some great advice from a native-born American that was pretty much the same. She said, I have twins too. Get help. I got 6 weeks of relatives to come one after another, my favorite relatives that I was comfortable with, mm-hmm. and one after another they tag teamed. And I said, Claudia said, oh, that's ghastly. You're going to have 6 weeks of house guests and babies? That is so not what I want to do. And she said, no, you've got it wrong. You won't have house guests. They will be taking care of you. Hmm. And one after another, I recruited a lot of friends, too, but relatives came as well. They came, they tidied the house, they kept me company. We drank oregano tea together, read quietly together, and we're just companions together because, at least for me, and I do think for a lot of first-time moms, there's a lot of anxiety and fear, and to have someone there. And another piece of it is that Mike, my husband, he did his bit, and that's not traditional at all. He sure was part of the quarantena and has continued to be so, but we've got that tradition in the United States. It's an amazing development, in the past half century of how engaged dads are with their kids. So they play a great part in that calming, supporting role, too. That's an advantage and an adaptation of the quarantena that we've got that is not traditional in Chiapas. Although, I will say that the men here that I met often took over. Hmm. They were comfortable, and one guy in Akron, Ohio, I did my research, said, yes, I was sweeping in front of the house, and a woman said, I've never seen a man wield a broom before. And he said, this is my job. I've got to do it. Hmm. And they took great pride in the care they took of their wives. They were greatly engaged in that.
Reading about this also reminds me that it is both a strength of the American character and perhaps also a weakness that we have this sense of rugged individualism, like we shouldn't ever have to ask for anybody's help. And that's not true for anybody, realistically.
No. And also, we have that strain, but these ways of helping each other and reciprocity are deeply, deeply a part of our culture. The rugged individualism is part of it, but think of our quilting bees and barn raisings, bucket brigades, and I'm rereading Little House on the Prairie, and with my 6-year-old, I think it's a masterpiece. And there is much talk of Mr. Edwards, the good neighbor, and borrowing nails from a neighbor. And do you want to borrow something so precious as nails? And Pa said, well, he knows I'm going to give them back. Mm-hmm. This is Americans through and through.
Yeah,
this is how we got to be where we are.
You build my barn this week, and I'll build yours next week.
Exactly.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Sherry on the line in Tyler. Hi, Sherry.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I just wanted to make a comment. I think that this is such a relevant subject, and I think that as Americans, we are doing ourselves a great disservice by the anti-immigrant attitude that we seem to harbor and in tough economic times. I think as an American, I have learned so much from immigrants, legal and illegal, and that the care and nurturing that they show their families is, I admire so much, and I wish that I was raised in that environment. It's such an enriching experience when you see it occur, and I'm so grateful that this woman has written this book, and I hope that that she changes the attitudes of more people. We do have so much to learn as a society and as a culture from others who really have it down better than Americans do on this subject.
Thank you so much for your call. Have you heard, Claudia, from a lot of native-born Americans who say, I want to try that, or I want to do what you talked about in Chapter 4?
I have. Mm-hmm. I have. It's been really striking, and it's also been fun to hear people stepping forward and say, well, I'm Italian, but, you know, my grandmother had a little black book just like those Indians and Pakistanis in the assisted marriage chapter. Yes, they're enticing. I mean, these are not randomly chosen practices. They're practices that really spoke to me and worked to me, and I was envious of before I tried them out for myself.
Let's talk about assisted marriage. People know what arranged marriage is, but assisted marriage is a little bit different.
Yes, and it's, you know, and for me, it was counterintuitive. My parents were 100% love matched. To say that they were not encouraged is an understatement. although once they got married, their all the families just embraced them, and the whole family ethic just activated. But I was resistant to it, and it was funny because when I told my mother about it, she hated the idea of assisted marriage until I explained, no, this is a very different matter from arranged marriage. Arranged marriage still goes on all over the world. It has advocates. I don't think it's very workable in this culture, and it's also an instrument of great suffering for many little girls and little boys all over the world. Arranged marriage is when your parents, for economic reasons or even just for what they think is your best interest, marry you off, and you have no say in it. And assisted marriage is something absolutely different. It's practiced and requested by what's called the 1.5 generation, which is South Asians, Indians, Pakistanis, others from that region, who were born abroad but grew up here, or else were born and raised here but in Indian or Pakistani families. And they reach around 25 or 30. They've maybe dated. They had no interest in anyone meddling in their love lives. And then, like a lot of us, they found it's kind of a jungle out there. Mm-hmm. This is hard. I'm not having fun anymore. I just want to settle down with someone who really cares about me. And they are asking their parents for help. They're not asking to be set up and marched off to marriage. They're asking for something called biodata. And biodata is, it's a resume of your eligibility and your characteristics as a potential spouse. And parents use their little black books, which often they've been secretly compiling for decades and decades. They talk to what are called aunties, which may be a real aunt, or it might just be a beloved family member, and they get the networks going. This is my son. This is my daughter. She's like this, this, and this. And then they collect these written pieces of information about prospective mates, and they pass them on to the eligible person who reviews them, sometimes very carefully in notebooks with tabs and color codings. I even saw someone who didn't care for one offering, and she actually tore it out of her notebook and handed it on to a friend. And then they meet these people. And they, the one thing that parents can't do is determine if there's going to be chemistry there.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what parents can do, and you know, I need to say, not flawlessly, of course, But parents are pretty good at finding out, using a lot of times old country networks. Well, you know, what's the mother-in-law like? Is she going to be good to my daughter? Or, is the father of that family? Does he have a temper? Is he going to be a good father-in-law? What do we know about this family? Is the young guy a good guy? What do we know about his peers? So they have an intense interest in getting this right, and they ask, but we were considered very unseemly questions, and you know, they are not always correct. But a lot enough of the time they are that many South Asian professionals with lots of choices are asking for this help. And the one there's one rule: the young people have to be serious about marriage.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a dating service, and everyone will be furious at you if you use it as a dating service. You all have to be serious. And so I'm guessing that the South Asians, the young people in this country are asking for it. They tend to be a little older. The people I met weren't asking for it in college or right out of college. But not long after college, they began to see the appeal of this. And the funny thing is that their parents, who oftentimes had arranged marriages that they found very satisfactory, and that's a theme you hear over and over, is this arranged marriage turned out pretty well, but the parents would never want to arrange a marriage for the kids. They
mm-hmm.
don't want the responsibility. It's so much trouble. It's a lot of work. But when their kids ask for, it's called assisted marriage or sometimes assisted introduction.
Mm-hmm.
Many parents are willing to, you know, they pay for the college education and they feel this is in, you know, in the repertoire of services they owe to their kids.
Well, what I liked in reading this chapter, Claudia, and I have four children now, and it's interesting to me that, you know, before, you know, when I was 25, the only thing you're thinking about is falling madly in love with somebody. And then after you've been married for a while and you think about what it takes to make a successful marriage, the list of qualities, some may drop off the list and others may be bumped up that you never considered before. And moms and dads understand that for their kids.
Absolutely. And I want, absolutely, the people who love you, and of course there are dating services, there are all kinds of algorithmic services on the internet, which also often have really good results, but I have not heard as many impassioned advocates of it as I have among South Asian professionals that assisted marriage. They know you. They just want to see you happy because they're going to live with you for alongside of you or by phone for forever. And so one of the adaptations that really works well in this country is it doesn't have to be your mom or your sister. Sisters often get very involved. It could be your friend who is like a sister,
mm-hmm.
or your pal from college who at this point, you know, has spent more time with you than your dad even did. So, you know, we in the United States, we use friends as family a lot, and I think it works very well here. The main thing, as you said, is who knows you well, who knows what makes you happy, who has your best interests deeply, deeply at heart.
Is there any difference in the number of women who are interested in this as compared with the number of men?
Who are interested in it?
You know, the story in this country is that guys don't want to settle down and women want to get married. And I know that's a gross mischaracterization, but I'm wondering if there's any sort of gap in the number of people who are interested.
I don't know that anyone has done a numerical study,
mm-hmm.
but for every successful assisted heterosexual marriage in this community, there's a person of the opposite gender.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly there's at least an equal number of men and women saying yes. So that's one piece of it. And the men I talked to were all for it.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, in you know, the couple in my story, that the man was a business guy. He's like, I think you need to sell this as a business. You need mm-hmm. to get customer reviews. And, I could see this catching fire. And then I did a sort of an experiment that was a little bit of a lark, but I did go to a South Asian marriage website, which, again, very different from dating. In theory, everyone there wanted to be married, and I sort of dabbled in there, and I was startled by, you know, the large number of nice men who said that they were ready to look for marriage partners. So that's anecdotal.
And you actually had a lesbian friend say, hey, will you do this for me?
Yes, I did. I did, and I did it gladly. Well, I knew, I thought that she would be a very easy subject because she's just adorable. Mm-hmm. Everyone loves her. And she was serious and ready to settle down. And I need to say, I was an abject failure at it. And I thought it would be a piece of cake. Mm. I first of all thought, okay, well, you know, you just send out an email blast to everybody you know. And then I thought, no, she's very special. So I have to pare it down to the people I would want to send me potential spouses. So that narrows down to a teeny tiny number. It's hard to explain, and I needed to tell everyone she's gorgeous and smart and adorable and not desperate. And so then I was taking up just tons and tons of email space. And then the bottom line was I was not panicked enough about her prospects. And she's lovable. She's loved by many, many people, and I wasn't even sure if I wanted her to settle down. I mean, she was just a little young stripling of, you know, in her late 20s, and, you know, I just didn't want to rush her into anything. But seriously, I think that I underestimated how much work it is and how much concentration and focus it takes to slowly, patiently, over years, gather prospects that may be suitable in every way for someone you really, really care about.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Sanjeev on the line in Allen. Hi, Sanjeev.
Hi. I am of Indian origin, and I've lived in the U.S. for a long, long time. And, you know, I met my wife, I met through grad school. So, you know, I took the more traditional love marriage route, as it's called. But my observation was that the thing that your guest is talking about, assisted marriage, is really the way arranged marriage has been happening in India, at least for my generation. Yeah, because for a long time in India now, arranged marriage really isn't arranged marriage. You know, parents make the introductions, the girl and the boy date for a little bit, and if it works out, they get married. Otherwise, you know, both of them move on to find another partner and so on.
Yeah, well, let's. I think Claudia can comment on that after we take our break, because we're about to go into a moment here of sponsorship and things like that. But we will continue our conversation with Claudia Kolker in just a moment. She's a former Los Angeles Times bureau chief and member of the Houston Chronicle's editorial board. Her new book is called The Immigrant Advantage: What We Can Learn from Newcomers to America About Health, Happiness, and Hope. If you want to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Claudia Kolker. We're talking about her new book, The Immigrant Advantage: What We Can Learn from Newcomers to America About Health, Happiness, and Hope. And I wonder if you want to respond to Sanjeev's point that even in today's India, many marriages are more assisted than arranged.
Yes, I do. I just also wanted to amend something from the previous segment, which is that I'm a former member of the Chronicle editorial board and now a contributing editor.
Oh, so, thank you. Okay.
Sure. And yes, I'm glad he pointed that out, because indeed this originates from India. And so definitely arranged marriage, especially for people who are economically disadvantaged, is still very, very common and an issue for very young girls. But it has blossomed in India, as he said, in the last generation, because young women are becoming professionals, having more choices, and asking and demanding that they have more say in who they're with. And parents are becoming more open to it too, because they know that their daughters and sons will have to travel a lot of times for work. There's now more mobility, more opportunity. And so they're going to be stuck with each other. And so it is, it's more important in some ways than it used to be that they really enjoy each other, because a lot of times they won't have a big extended family as they have had for millennia around them to perhaps distract from an infelicitous marriage. So he's got it exactly right from what I saw in my research too, that this is an import.
So let's talk about this wonderful Vietnamese tradition called monthly rice, which seems like it was tailor-made for a gigantic generation of current American working parents.
I know. Isn't it extraordinary? And I know it well in Houston, and I know that it is thriving also in California. And so I'm now going to make it a quest to really hunt it down in every city with a Vietnamese population. But this is something, okay, it's called monthly rice, and I'll again, with miserable pronunciation, but I'll tell you how it's said. It's com tang in Vietnamese, and to Vietnamese listeners, forgive me, please. I just wanted the word to be in there. This is, it's subscription. It's meals by subscription, and it's often a housewife or a widow, someone, usually women with very little resources and a lot of energy and motivation, who cooks home-style food, not fancy, not overly greasy, not expensive, not salty, not overly salty. It's not restaurant food. It's home food. They cook it in large quantities in their kitchen, and they have to be good cooks because otherwise they won't have any clients. Mm-hmm. They get a monthly subscription, like to your local newspaper, and then traditionally they will drop off that night's dinner on your stove or in a cooler in front of your house at least every night, say between 5 and 7. So a lot of them have keys to your house. And the meal, Vietnamese traditionally are very picky about what they eat, and there has to be a savory course, salty course, something crunchy, rice, soup, and they traditionally don't like frozen foods, much mm-hmm. less canned foods. So this very hardworking small businesswoman makes home cooked meals for 50 or 100 people, and then she and or a helper go and deliver it. And did I mention that the price is usually $7 or $8 for a meal that feeds a family of four?
Wow. So this is not only like a magical fairy comes to your home and makes food that you don't have time to make, but it is not, it's actually more economical than people who are so pressed for time and end up stopping for fast food.
Yes, it mm-hmm. is. It is. And it's made by someone you know who often knows your tastes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's super fresh. She goes to the market that day and she finds out, she buys what's fresh that day. It's fantastic. It's actually, now it's changed a little bit from when I first discovered it. I heard of it, probably 10, 15 years ago for the very first time. And it was someone working in her kitchen, which is, you know, it's illegal in about 10 different ways. And now in Houston, they have storefront little shops.
Hmm.
You can get it. You can get it legit now. But it's still very humble food. One of the best dishes was scrambled eggs with bitter melon.
Hmm.
I mean, you know, it probably cost her pennies to make. If I made it at home, it would just be gnarly. But it was delicious. And I found that there was something very meaningful in knowing the person who was making that food and saying hello to her every day.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have George on the line in Arlington. Hey, George.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Hey, I just wanted to make a comment. This is the first time I'm ever talking on radio.
Welcome.
But I find this subject very interesting. I am a second-generation Mexican-American. Both my parents are from Mexico. And I am married to an American woman who is native-born. And this whole issue of the reciprocity is something that we always talk about, because I am, from my cultural background, my teaching, was taught that no matter what, if someone needs help, regardless of the circumstances, you go over there, whether it's, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning or midday. Whereas my wife, she makes sure that whoever we're helping, that it is the most convenient time for both her and for them. And so there's always a hesitation of helping somebody just because, you know, she feels that you're imposing on people, where I am, you know, if they need help, no matter what, we need to go help them.
What do you think about that, Claudia?
Well, I do think that, you know, the rhythm of our lives here is very different. And so I think there's a lot to that. Another example of that is in traditional cultures, it's a delight when someone knocks on your door and shows up and then maybe, you know, sticks around for an hour. What a treat. And in this culture, it's not our tradition, and it's also, it can be enormously annoying. You know, mm-hmm. if you're working all day and you get home and you've got 1.5 hours to spend with your kids, a knock at the door for an unsolicited visit is not welcome. So that is absolutely true, that the rules and boundaries by necessity are a little bit different here. But at the same time, you know, Americans are also very, I'm talking about North Americans, are known for our instinct to help, to step up, and actually to give and volunteer without any expectation of get back at all. So that's in our tradition.
Why is a stoop or a front porch such a great resource for new American families?
Well, for new American families or for all?
Well, for all American families, but one that new American families seem to really take advantage of.
For a lot of reasons. Well, new American families, and we're talking especially about a chapter about Mexican Americans in Chicago, because their houses are small and uncomfortable and cramped, and they don't have gardens and back decks with pools. The front of the house is where you get some fresh air, some change of scenery, and you get to watch the world go by, including your neighbors. So that's the practical why. This mm-hmm. is why people sit on their front steps, and it's considered, oh, you know, how unfortunate, people lurking out in front of their house. It's, you know, it's unsightly. But actually, it's also a joy, and it can really strengthen a neighborhood in a lot of subtle ways. And there are a lot of threads going through this. Again, in Little Village in Chicago, people would just tell me, well, this is what we do. We just watch the world go by. Mm-hmm. But it may be linked to a lower rate of asthma in that community because, contrary to what you might think, asthma is usually, if you've got asthma, it's better to be outside than mm-hmm. inside. There are all kinds of pollutants outside, but at least you're not trapped indoors with formaldehyde and bug droppings and indoor pollutants. There's a little more circulation of air. Also, if you're sitting on your front steps, you'll probably get up and go to the gate and look out to talk to somebody. You might even wander down the street. So you're moving more. There is more movement. But the most important thing is you are engaging with your neighbors. And it's hard. Again, in our culture, it is not so comfortable to engage with the neighbors. You're rushing home from work. You want to get inside. You just kind of don't know the neighbors. Why mm-hmm. would you? And in fact, a great portion of Americans don't know our next-door neighbors' names. Mm. But if you know your neighbors, if there is a robbery, you will see something happening and you know the name of the person, you can call the police. If you see somebody fall or an elderly person look ill, there might be some familiarity there, and you can then step up and help that person. And these sound like small things, but actually disaster preparation experts are now saying this is important to disaster preparedness, is know your neighbors. Mm-hmm. Know who lives on your street, who's elderly, who has trouble walking, because if you can help them in a disaster, your community will bounce back more quickly.
And what's remarkable is that flies in the face of the way that so many new neighborhoods are being built in this country these days. You have these giant garages and you go in maybe through the alley, and the whole experience is designed to shelter you from the street instead of bringing you out there.
It is true. It is true. And that's because we've been so fortunate. This is simply an example of American abundance, because we have air conditioning. We can be in our houses now. People for a long time had money for backyard pools. We have entertainment centers. We have so many gifts and blessings that we can hunker down in our homes. Unfortunately, locking ourselves in like that to enjoy those gifts and blessings actually has some bad effects.
When Jamaican families come to this country, they often retain the tradition of living in multi-generational households. What are the primary benefits of that?
Well, the primary benefits at first are economic, and Americans are outliers, native-born Americans are outliers in that we don't live with extended families. We don't live with our parents very much after, you know, 18, 20. So the first one for people who come to this country is they're struggling economically. They need all the money they can get, so they squeeze in. The interesting thing about Jamaicans is that they are not as poor as many people who come to this country. They don't and they don't need to live together as long as they do, often into their 40s. They'll say, We get better child care because there are many generations in the house to take care of our kids, and they're loving our kids rather than just paid to take care of them.
Mm-hmm.
We can get the advanced degrees that we idealize and dream of. This is a huge cultural value, is higher education. Not everyone can get it, but it's easier to get it if there are a lot of adult wage earners in the house. We can go to send our kids to better schools because we're all living together, and so we can afford a slightly better house or than we could on our own. We can allow our younger generation to save up for home ownership. Jamaicans have a really high rate of home ownership relative to other immigrants, and it's partly because they just can't stand to rent. Many of them, not all, but there is a tradition, don't rent when you can own. Save your pennies and own that house. But here's the final thing, which was so intriguing to me. They enjoy it.
Hmm.
Not all. They're just as, you know, just as many loopy families among Jamaicans as the rest of us. It's always important to not romanticize, but they'll say, we enjoy it. It's fun. And there was a saying that I heard several times, which stopped me in my tracks, which is, we don't believe you have to fall out of love with your parents when you reach 18.
Hmm. What are the challenges for second-generation Americans in keeping these traditions alive, even if they grew up with them in this country? Do they tend to break away after if they were born here?
Well, again, I'm not sure if there's much research really examining that precisely. But first of all, I think this culture today is much more appreciative of the things that being bicultural can bring. And language is a great example. There is a huge and justified groundswell of support for learning other languages, for being bilingual, trilingual, and that really that's an immigrant advantage,
mm-hmm.
for that second generation. That's good for all of us. There's no downside to knowing more than one language, and from knowing it early on too. But that's going to be much easier for the second generation now than it was for their parents in Texas. I was just talking to an older man who was remembering with a lot of pain how much punishment he got by mistakenly letting a word or two of Spanish slip out in a public school. A generation ago. That doesn't happen anymore. We have better ways of teaching English now, I think. There are still challenges. Everyone wants to fit in, and I don't fault anyone ever for doing what it takes to be American. And foreign-born Americans need to work on being American too, especially with language acquisition. But it's hard, you know. Growing up is a process of sorting out what your parents told you that was right, and what you don't want, the cargo you don't want to take with you anymore. It's always a challenge. But I would say this culture is so much more understanding that, again, more is more. We need all the resources and the smarts that we can get, and we'll take them from wherever they are.
Have you tried to prepare your daughters for the possibility that someday you might help them choose a spouse if they're interested?
No, that hasn't come up, although they have already made some real estate plans with a big house with a room for each of them on the side, and then me and my husband a little quarters right in the middle. So they have already got plans for us to live together forever, and I'm all for it.
Claudia Kolker is a former bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times and contributing editor now to the Houston Chronicle. Her new book is called The Immigrant Advantage, What We Can Learn from Newcomers to America About Health, Happiness, and Hope. Claudia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, and thank you to the listeners who called in.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Christine McConnell produces the podcast, and our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think, and email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.